Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now beginning a study of the book of Deuteronomy. In this first audio concerning Deuteronomy, I'll take up Deuteronomy 1, verses 1 through 8. We'll look at some introductory material to the book, and then we'll look at Moses' retrospect on the command for the Israelites to leave Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, and to head on to the Promised Land. We start now with an introduction. This is mainly from the NIV Study Bible. What does the title mean? What does Deuteronomy mean? It means the, quote, repetition of the law. Now, that word Deuteronomy, repetition of the law, arose from a mistranslation in both the Septuagint and the Vulgate of Deuteronomy 17:18. Deuteronomy 17 and 18 says this, when he, that's the Israelite king appointed for the future, when he is seated on his royal throne, he is to write a copy of this instruction for himself on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. Now, the copy of a law is not quite the same thing as a repetition of the law. It doesn't mean the same thing. However, the mistranslation, the error is not really serious because Deuteronomy actually is, in a certain sense, a repetition of the law. Some people say that the original law, which is given in Exodus and Deuteronomy and Leviticus, was for the priest, very technical here. It's more exhortatory for the people to keep that law, and I think that makes a lot of sense. But at any rate, that's what Deuteronomy means, repetition of the law, even though the title does not exactly reflect what is meant in the book. Now, who's the author of this book? Moses is the author, and I'm going to go through a lot of proof of this because there are certain liberals who hold to the JEDP theory. If you look at Wikipedia on Deuteronomy, all liberal scholars, all secular scholars, and most Christian scholars say that Moses didn't write the book. It's Joshua, JEDP. D is Deuteronomy, and that's, I forgot the dates that these people, I don't pay too much attention to them, but they've got the date way beyond when Moses lived, so Moses didn't write the book. Well, let's look at some evidence that Moses did write the book. First of all, in the book itself, Moses is stated as the author. Deuteronomy 1:5, across the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses undertook to expound this law. Deuteronomy 31:9, so Moses wrote this law and gave it to the priest. Deuteronomy 31:22, so Moses wrote this song. That's the song of Moses the same day. Deuteronomy 31:24, it came about when Moses finished writing the words of this law in a book until they were complete. So the book itself says that Moses did it. Now, there are other Old Testament books besides Deuteronomy that attribute the authorship of the book to Moses. 1 Kings 2:3, keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in his ways, keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies according to what is written in the law of Moses. 1 Kings 8:53, for you have separated them from all the peoples of the earth as your inheritance, as you spoke through Moses, your servant, when you brought our fathers forth from Egypt, O Lord God. 2 Kings 14:6, but the sons of the slayers he did not put to death, according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, as the Lord commanded, saying, the fathers should not be put to death for their sons. 2 Kings 18:12, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant, even all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded. Well, there's... So now we have the book of Deuteronomy itself saying Moses wrote the book. We have other books in the Old Testament besides Deuteronomy, namely 1 and 2 Kings, that said that Moses wrote the book. How about Jesus? You know, Jesus, the Son of God, what did he say? Matthew 19:7-8. Why then, they asked him, did Moses command us to give divorce papers and send her away? He told them, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because of the hardness of your hearts, but it was not like that from the beginning. Jesus said that Moses wrote it. John 5:46-47, Jesus again speaks, and he says, for if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. Moses wrote all this. How about other New Testament figures besides Jesus? Well, we have Peter in Acts 3, verse 22. Moses said, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. That's a quote from Peter from Deuteronomy 18:15. A prophet like me, prophet like Moses. Moses said this according to Peter. Then Stephen in Acts 7:37-38, this is the Moses who said to the Israelites, God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers. He is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai. This is all talking about Moses. That's Stephen. So we've got Peter and Stephen. Now, how about Paul the Apostle, Romans 10:19? But I ask, did Israel not understand first? Moses said, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. Paul thought that Moses wrote the Torah, the Pentateuch, the book of Deuteronomy. Why in the world can't we? Mark 12:19. This is the Pharisees saying, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaves his wife behind, and leaves no child, his brother shall take his wife and produce offering for the brother. Pharisees said that, or I guess it was a Pharisee, I haven't gone back and checked, but whoever's inquiring of Jesus said that, and Jesus did not contradict him. Oh, Moses didn't write that. Haven't you ever heard of the JEDP hypothesis? And in addition to all these scriptural citations of Moses as the author, we have tradition, which uniformly testifies to Mosaic authorship. So folks, Moses wrote the book. Now, that doesn't mean that certain parts, that all every individual part was written by Moses. Some people say that the preamble, verses 1-5, which we are going to go through in just a minute, some people say that that preamble is written by somebody else, probably because Moses is referred to in the third person. Let me read you the first verse of the preamble. Deuteronomy 1:1, these are the words Moses spoke to all Israel. Well, I don't see why that's an ironclad argument that Moses didn't write that preamble. He could just be referring to himself in the third person. Big deal. So I'm not going to worry about the preamble. Adam Clark said that Joshua or Ezra probably wrote the preamble. Well, maybe so, but I don't have any problem with Moses writing the preamble. But now the one thing that old liberals love to jump on this, if Moses wrote Deuteronomy, how do you explain Deuteronomy 34:5? So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, as the Lord had said. Moses records his own death? That's not possible. Well, of course, it's not, or most probably it's not. I'll give you an argument that Moses actually did write that in a minute, but I think it's a little far-fetched. But yeah, sure, Moses didn't write that. This is a little postscript to the book, a little editorial comment. Lots of books are finished by editors. J.R.R. Tolkien's last book was Matthew Henry's sixth volume of his commentary was finished up by an editor. Lots and lots of authors who write and write and write, and they get old, and then they croak before they get the book published, and then their author comes out and finishes the book. Happens all the time. And that could very well have happened with Moses. John Gill suggests 4 options as to who could have put the finishing editorial comments on the book. Joshua, maybe Samuel, maybe Eleazar, maybe Ezra. Many modern scholars just leave the question open and don't even try to answer it. This is according to Richard McDonald, writing for the Gospel Coalition. Some modern scholars who leave the question open and don't bother to answer it are Eugene Merrill, Edward J. Woods, and Dan Block. Well, that's kind of the way I look at it. I don't really care who put it there. Now, some people argue that Moses wrote it himself, God having revealed to Moses his death beforehand, God having revealed that he was going to die there in the land of Moab. Remember, God told Moab, you're not going into the promised land. You remember that story when he was at the striking the rock at Kadesh Barnea in anger. God says, you're not going to go, you and Aaron are not going to go into the promised land. So some people say, yeah, well, he knew he was going to die there, so he put it in the book ahead of time. That's an interesting argument, but I don't think that's probably what's going on here. Now, what kind of authority did the book of Deuteronomy have for Jesus? Jesus quotes Deuteronomy as authoritative, Matthew 4:4, but he answered, it is written, man must not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Jesus believed in Deuteronomy as scripture, and when you hear it is written, that means scripture. Matthew 4:7, Jesus said to him, that's the devil, said to the devil, on the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. So he's quoting Deuteronomy there when he quotes the devil. And he's quoting Deuteronomy with a view to making the devil scram or leave him alone or quit oppressing him. So Jesus really believed that Deuteronomy was authoritative. Matthew 4:10. Then Jesus said to him, this is the devil, go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. Another quotation from Deuteronomy. And in fact, the New Testament has almost 100 quotations or allusions to Deuteronomy, according to the NIV Study Bible. So, Deuteronomy is very much a part of the New Testament. It is incorporated into the law of Christ, into the New Testament, and it's a valuable book. It has authority. Now, what about the style of Deuteronomy? The style contrasts with the matter-of-fact narrative of Leviticus and Numbers. Moses is personal, warm, and sermonic. That's according to the NIV Study Bible. Kyle and Dillich say this, quote, accordingly, he, Moses, does not quote laws in the categorical language of law. but clothes them, as well as the other commandments, in the hortatory form of a paternal address, full of solemn and affectionate admonition. Well, folks, I guarantee you, law is not personal, warm, or sermonic. I've read enough of it to know it's dry as dust. And if we've gone through Leviticus and Numbers, and oh my goodness, and Exodus, oh my goodness, some of that law is very, very difficult. And it's not personal, warm, or sermonic, but it is here in the book of Deuteronomy. So that's an interesting distinction between the law as recorded in the earlier chapters of the Torah and in Deuteronomy. Here's some other characteristics that have been ascribed to the book, according to the NIV Study Bible. It's interpretive. It's repetitious. It's reminiscent. It's somewhat irregular. It's a series of more or less extemporaneous addresses. It's sometimes in non-chronological order. That's a lot of books are like that. And the book clearly reflects Near Eastern suzerain vassal treaties, which emphasize the covenant between God and his people. It's a lot about covenant in the book, in other words. In fact, the book of Deuteronomy is essentially a covenant renewal document. What's the date of Deuteronomy? Chuck Swindoll says it's probably 1406 B.C. Of course, that all depends on when you believe Moses has lived, when the Exodus was and all that, the early date and the late date. I always take the early date in the 15th century B.C. And, of course, you've got to figure out when the Exodus was and how long Moses lived. I'm not going to go through all that. Let's just take 1406 as the rough time when the book was written. What was the purpose of the book? The purpose was to confirm the covenant. It was not to give a second law. And a lot of times you hear Deuteronomy, second law. Oh, here we have another law. No, it's the same law. It's a confirmation of the first law. Kyle and Dillich say this, quote, "There is not the slightest trace throughout the whole book of any intention whatever to give a new or second law." Now, Kyle and Dillich, having made that statement, do point out that some precepts were added. For example, there was one site for the worship of God, which is later going to be Jerusalem. Only one temple. Also added were some regulations for legitimate prophets and a godly king, a legal king. Some precepts were added for the administration of justice, for the legal system, and for carrying on of war. They were added, but it's all part of the same law. Now, what about the literary composition of the book? This is from Kyle and Dillich, who say that there were two sections of the book. The first section is the first 30 chapters. The second section is the last four chapters, chapters 31 through 34. Now, the first section, chapters 1 through 30, is divided into three addresses of Moses to the people. The first address is from Deuteronomy 1:6 after the preamble to Deuteronomy 4:40. And there we read of Moses talking about the history of Israel recounted to prepare for the exposition and the enforcement of the law. So we'll have a lot of history in the first address. The second address is Deuteronomy 5 through verse 26, where the Sinaitic law is repeated. Same law is mentioned again to the people. By the way, there's a couple verses between the first and second address about the cities of refuge. I don't know why they're thrown in there, but they are. But that's not going to detract us from the overall bird's eye view of the structure of the book. After the second address, which ends in chapter 26, we see the third address, which goes from chapters 27 through chapter 30, which is the renewal of the covenant as the people agree to keep that covenant as was given to them at Mount Horeb. So that's the first section of the book, the three addresses in the first section. Now, the second section of the book, which is from Deuteronomy 31 through 34, describes the winding up of Moses' life and his ministry and the appointment of Joshua. So there's our overview of the book. We can now begin with Deuteronomy 1:1. These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel across the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arabah opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, and Laban and Hazeroth and Dazahab. Now, Moses is speaking. That means he's about to give his address. In fact, as I just finished saying, almost all of Deuteronomy is speeches made by Moses in the last months of his life. So the book of Deuteronomy is a book of speeches. And it's in the 40th year, the end of the 40 years since they left Sinai. So that gives us a focused idea of the time of Deuteronomy, the 40th year of the Exodus in the last year of Moses' life. And we also have a specific place that these speeches were given is mentioned in verse 1, across the Jordan. Remember, they haven't crossed the Jordan River yet, so they're on the east side of the Jordan River. In the last chapters of Numbers, we talked all about the adventures of the Israelites in the plains of Moab, which basically the east side of the Arabah Valley, the Jordan River. mostly near the northern tip of the Dead Sea. That's the plains of Moab. Now, this area that Moses is giving these speeches is called wilderness in verse 1. That's the wilderness of Moab, if you want to give it a proper name, where Israel had been camped for some time. The Arabah, of course, is that valley that runs from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea, then south of the Dead Sea all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. And from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea in the Gulf of Arabah flows the Jordan River. Now, it says that wilderness is in the Arabah. Well, they were a little bit to the east of the Arabah up there in the plains of Moab, opposite Suf. Now, the NIV Study Bible says that Suf and all the other places mentioned in this verse, which I'm not going to try to locate, they are places that the Israelites, or that can be found at least from Sinai to Moab, and they basically describe the boundaries and limits of Moab, because after all, that's where Moses is, in the plains of Moab. Now, one little note here about Paran. I love these scholars. Here's the Net Bible. That's the Bible put up by Dallas Theological Seminary. It says that Paran is the well-known wilderness of Paran from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, which we've talked about with plenty of repetition in our previous discussions in the book of Numbers and Exodus. And the wilderness of Paran is there. You go from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, which is at the northern end of the wilderness of Paran, and at the southern end of the wilderness of Zin, Z-I-N, or Tsin. So that's well known. That's what the Net Bible says. But then John Gill says, no, that can't be the wilderness of Paran. That's too far from Moab. So the scholars totally disagree with each other, and I think Gill's got a point. If Paran is the name of the desert and not a city, why is it mentioned here? That's a long way away from where they are. We go now to Deuteronomy 1:2. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Now, Horeb is the usual name for Mount Sinai in Deuteronomy. There's only one exception in Deuteronomy 33:2. Why the difference in names? Well, it could be that Horeb is the range of mountain in which Sinai, a particular peak, was located. Let me give you a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, Horeb was the general name of a mountainous district, literally the parched or burnt region, whereas Sinai was the name appropriated to a particular peak. Now, why is it mentioned in verse 2 that it was 11 days' journey from Horeb, Mount Sinai, to Kadesh Barnea, which is in the wilderness of Paran right there at the northern end of the Sinai desert? Why mention that? Why did Moses mention that? Well, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown and Clark say, it was mentioned in order to contrast the 38 years it took Israelites to make it to the Promised Land. In other words, hey, we should have been there in 11 days, and it took us 38 years. Because Kadesh Barnea is right on the southern end of the Promised Land, so we go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea, we're right on the doorway of going into the Promised Land. It should have taken 11 days. It took us 11 days to get up there. Actually, John Gill says it's 3 days, but... And what Gill is saying is the normal travel time for normal people was accepted to be 11 days, but the Israelites hot-footed it up there pretty quick. For 3 days, I don't know if Gill is right or not, but let's just say it took 11 days to get up there. 11 days, you get there, and then 38 years later, you finally enter into the Promised Land. Now, why is that, Israel? Well, it's because of their apostasy and rebellion, that's why. Now, verse 2 says it is 11 days from Horeb, by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. What is Mount Seir? Well, if you look at a map, you look at the Dead Sea, go down the Arabah Valley, go in south until you hit the Gulf of Aqaba. And if you go east of the Arabah Valley, there's a mountain range going from the southern tip of the Dead Sea to the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. It continues on down on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, but for our purposes, it basically runs from the southern tip of the Dead Sea to Eilat, which is the city at the tip, the Jewish city, still there, at the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And to the east of this valley there, there's a range of mountains running all along the east side of the Gulf of Arabah. That's Mount Seir. Now, the Israelites probably didn't go over there. They probably went to the western side of the Arabah Valley. But if you read it this way, it is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir. In other words, if you go along up with Mount Seir to your east, by the way of Mount Seir, to the east of Mount Seir, it's the same thing, to Kadesh Barnea. But I mentioned that geographical note because Mount Seir is mentioned so many times in the Old Testament, it's nice to kind of look at a map like I'm doing now and get a picture of where that mountain range is. Of course, Mount Seir was owned by the Edomites for much of ancient Old Testament history. In fact, Jameson Fawcett Brown describes Mount Seir as the mountainous country of Edom. It's what BibleAtlas.org says. In Genesis 32:3, the land of Seir is equated with the field of Edom. So sometimes the land of Seir is called the field of Edom. Continuing with the description in BibleAtlas.org, the mount and the land of Seir are alternative appellations of the mountainous tract which runs along the eastern side of the Arabah, occupied by the descendants of Esau, who succeeded the ancient Horites, H-O-R-I-T-E-S. Horites means cave dwellers. We go down to Deuteronomy 1, verses 3 through 5. In the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first of the month, Moses told the Israelites everything the Lord had commanded him to say to them. This was after he had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth at Edrei. Now this has happened in the 40th year. That means the 40th year after leaving Egypt. That was a bad year for the Israelites. On the first day of the first month of the 40th year, Miriam died in Numbers 20. On the first day of the fifth month of the 40th year, Aaron died. And now, near the end of the 40th year, Moses is going to die. This speech was given about a month before he died, according to James Fawcett and Brown. So in about another month, he's going to die. We're still in the 40th year. The 40th year was the wrapping up of the Exodus. Now, this time of the speech in verse 4 was after he, that's either Moses or God, it's not clear, probably Moses, I think, after Moses, or God, had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og of Bashan, the king of Bashan. Now, a brief review here. The land of Moab is from the southern tip of the Dead Sea, where the brook Zered runs in from the, going from east to west to the tip of the southern tip of the Dead Sea, all the way up to the Arnon River, halfway up the Dead Sea. And Moab probably extended somewhere to the north of the Dead Sea around the city of Heshbon. And then you go, that's the Moabites, then you go north of there is the Ammonites. They go all the way up to the Jabbok River, which is halfway up the Jordan River going to the Sea of Galilee. Now, right before the Israelites showed up, some Amorite kings had encroached upon the land of the Moabites and the Ammonites, namely Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan, who was also an Amorite. The Amorites were famous, one of the big tribes of Canaan. In fact, they went out of Canaan and ended up in Syria and the Mesopotamian Valley at various times in their history. So they were a prominent pagan tribe. So these two Amorite kings had encroached upon Moab and Ammon, and they were there when the Israelites got there. Well, the Israelites did Moab and Ammon a favor and wiped them out. Now, Sihon lived in Heshbon, which is right there at the northern tip of the Dead Sea in Moab. And Og, king of Bashan, lived in Ashtaroth at Edrei. Now, those places are not well known. But if you will look at the map as you go up the King's Highway, which is that highway to the east of the hill country on the Transjordan, east of the Jordan River, you go up out of Moab, you go into the former lands of Ammon and past the Jabbok River. You keep going north and north until you get to the Yarmouk River. And the Yarmouk River is the river which runs into the Jordan River right south of the tip of the Dead Sea. And the King's Highway sort of bends toward the east. It goes through Ramoth Gilead, famous place. And it ends up at the Yarmouk River. Right there at the Yarmouk River is a place called Edrei. E-D-R-E-I, Edrei, I guess you pronounce it. And that's where the Israelites whipped up on Og, king of Bashan. Bashan is that area right to the east of the Dead Sea, the Golan area. Now, Bashan was from Ashtaroth, so if you continue from Edrei on the King's Highway, you keep going and you get right to the east of Golan, which is to the east of the Sea of Galilee, and you go up a little bit further north heading toward Damascus. You see the city of Ashtaroth, and that's where Og was from. I mentioned all this geography to show that this is not myth, this is history, this is narrative. So in verse 5, across the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses began to explain this law, saying, by the way, before I go to verse 5, let me talk about Ashtaroth again. Ashtaroth is kind of interesting because it was the seat of Rephaim, the giants, the famous race of the giants. When you hear Rephaim, when you hear Nephilim, or the Nephilim, however you pronounce them, you think giants, and Og was a giant. Remember, he had a bedspring. I think it's in the book of Judges. It talks about how big this iron bedstead was. It was so big that because Og was a giant, he had to live there. Well, he was from Ashtaroth. And Ashtaroth was named after Astarte, the very famous Middle Ancient Near Eastern goddess, the tutelary goddess of the Syrians, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown put it. I think Astarte had her start there in Phoenicia, so she had a city named after her. She's the one who gave us Easter eggs, Astarte eggs, I call them, because she was a fertility goddess, and her worship was accompanied with colored, painted eggs, and so now we do that on the day of our Lord's resurrection. Isn't that sweet? And we complain about the Israelites letting idolatry and paganism into their religion. Verse 5, Moses is said to explain the law. The NIV Study Bible expands on that a little bit and says, explaining the law meant to summarize the law, to interpret the law, to adjust the law to the new and specific situation Israelites would face in Canaan. In other words, earlier the law dealt with them as they were traveling through the wilderness, but now they're going to be settled in Canaan, and so certain things are going to come up. Also, to explain the law needed to be explained because Deuteronomy was a covenant renewal and updating document. I just mentioned updating, but also a covenant renewal so that when the Israelites heard the law, they said, okay, this is what the law is. Okay, that's right. We're going to obey it. Remember, it's been 38 years since they got the law. And Moses mentions this law, that's the Ten Commandments, and also other laws given at Mount Sinai, as the NIV Study Bible says. The Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, 20 through 24, the famous Ten Commandments, but also the laws in Leviticus and Numbers, all the laws were explained right here on the plains of Moab in Moses' speech. We go down to Deuteronomy 1, verses 6 through 7. Moses is speaking to the Israelites, quote, "The Lord our God spoke to us at Horeb, saying, 'You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Turn and set your journey and go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors in the Arabah, in the hill country and in the lowland and in the Negev and by the seacoast, the land of the Canaanites and Lebanon as far as the great river, the river Euphrates.'" Now, this is geography again, and it's so hard to talk about geography, but before we do that, let's look at a time statement. You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Now, we talked about this in Exodus. In Exodus 19:1, from the first of day of the third month after the departure to the 20th day of the second month. Took them a year to get to Mount Sinai. The first month of the second year, they had the Passover meal. And the second month of the second year, they had the second Passover meal for people who weren't available on the first month. And then in the third month, the 20th, that's Sivan, the 20th, off they took. And if you do all the calculations according to Gill and Clark, by the time they get here, ready to cross over the Jordan River, it's about approximately 38 years from Mount Sinai. How long did they stay at that Mount Sinai? Gill and Clark say it was 10 days less than a year. Now, I think those calculations are, I'm not sure how precise that is. I remember going through the calculations when we were in Exodus, or in Numbers too, for that matter, and I'm not sure that you can be that precise, but it was approximately a year. And so Moses is saying, see there, we set the tabernacle up, we built the tabernacle, we've given the law, we've set up altars, and we've sworn allegiance to God, and it took us a year. So now it's time to go. And so Moses says, go, and then he describes the land they're going to go to. And what he does is basically hits all of the promised land, as I'll show you as we go through. A similar description of the land they're going to go to is in Joshua 1:4, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, as far as the great sea, that's the Mediterranean Sea, towards the setting of the sun will be your territory. Well, we'll worry about that description when we get to Joshua. Right now, let's look at this description. First of all, go to the hill country of the Amorites. The NIV Study Bible says that's the central and southern mountains at the southern end of Israel, right near the western side of the Dead Sea, as the wilderness of Zin, going from south to north, kind of moves up and starts turning into some low hills. The hill country of the Amorites. The southern part of Canaan is where the spies were sent from, Kadesh Barnea. It's where the Amorites lived with the Amalekites, because we saw that when they were there, they had some dealings with the Amalekites. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that the hill country of the Amorites is that hilly tract lying next to Kadesh Barnea in the south of Canaan. So basically, it's the hills of the south of Canaan. That's the hill country of the Amorites, and to all their neighbors in the Arabah, that would be settlements to the east of that of the hill country as you go down toward the Arabah, as you go down to the Dead Sea, the Jordan River in that area, and then in the hill country, There's two phrases here, hill country of the Amorites and then also in the hill country. Well, that hill country is the midsection of the promised land running north and south of Canaan. In other words, right there in the guts of Israel, that's the hill country. The hill country of the Amorites is a little bit further to the south. Calvin Delitzsch describes this hill country here, not the hill country of the Amorites, but just the hill country, describes that section as, quote, the leading feature in the land of Canaan and is synonymous with the land of the Canaanites. The NIV translates it as the mountains. Verse 7, also there's a lowland mentioned. Well, the lowland, according to the NIV Study Bible, says these are western foothills sloping towards the Mediterranean. The translation, the NIV translation, in fact, translates it as western foothills. So to the east of the Arabah, east of this hill country, this ridge of mountains through the south to north going through the promised land, to the east is to the Arabah Valley, to the west is the western lowlands as you go toward the Mediterranean. And then in the south is mentioned, and in the Negev, that's the south desert, southern desert, the dry wasteland stretching southward from Beersheba. I've been through that desert. It's one of the highlights of my life. I wish I could go back. That word Negev means south. In fact, sometimes the Hebrew word for Negev is translated south. And then the seacoast is mentioned. And by the seacoast, well, that's the Mediterranean coastal strip. And then it's all described as the land of the Canaanites. That would be from the land of the Philistines, which is on the seacoast in the south, around Gaza, going north, all the way up to Mount Lebanon to the north of Israel in present-day Lebanon. That's the land of the Canaanites, going from the land of the Philistines to Mount Lebanon in Phoenicia. Now, Adam Clark points out that the terms Canaanites and Phoenicians are often confounded. That Clark says that, and Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, the name Canaanite is often used synonymously with that of Phoenician. So we need to keep that straight. Canaanite sometimes just refers to all the pagan tribes in Canaan, and sometimes it more particularly describes the people on the coast, more particularly the people on the northern coast, on the coast of the Mediterranean, that is to the north of Israel in present-day Lebanon. Well, all of that's very interesting. Let me just summarize it. We're talking about the promised land here. So basically, Moses tells the people that God has said, long enough at Mount Sinai, let's go to the promised land. And he gives a full description of it. Also, the Euphrates River is mentioned. God told the people, and Moses relates to the people what God has said. God says, go as far, Israel, as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, Adam Clark says that in Solomon's time, Abraham's promise was literally fulfilled. 1 Kings 4:21, which is one of my favorite verses. Now Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river, that's the Euphrates River, to the land of the Philistines. That's on the western lowlands there, the Shephelah, right there as you go toward the coast of the Mediterranean. And to the border of Egypt, that's going further south till you get to the Wadi El Arish, which divides Egypt from Israel. That's where Solomon ruled, from the south to the north. He had all that land. It was fulfilled. The reason I like that verse is because dispensationalists love to say that the promises of the land were not fulfilled. They're going to be fulfilled later in a geopolitical nation of Israel, which I do not believe because I'm not a dispensationalist. But this is a key verse in controversy here, 1 Kings 4:21. You might want to remember that one for future reference. We go now to Deuteronomy 1:8. See, I have placed the land before you, God continues, speaking to the Israelites. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers. This is actually Moses speaking God's words to the Israelites. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to them and their descendants after them. Go in, and Jameson Fawcett Brown says that from the description in verse 7, the description I just gave you of all those geographical places, one would think the order of conquest would be from east to west. I do not know why Jameson Fawcett Brown say that. It seems to me that it was kind of geographical features were given in no particular order. But at any rate, Jameson Fawcett Brown says eventually the order was just the opposite from west to east. Interesting little point. I guess we can check him up on that when we get to Joshua. Now, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the three generations of forefathers are mentioned here, who have all had land promises, possession of the land promises. The first one is Abraham, Genesis 15, 18 through 21. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt, that's the Wadi El Arish, as far as the river Euphrates. So Abraham is promised. And by the way, it was not a promise to Abraham, it was to your descendants, Abraham's descendants. Get the land promise. Isaac got the land promised. He's the first descendant of Abraham. NIV Study Bible says the promise to Abraham's descendants were later limited particularly to Isaac's descendants, because Abraham had more descendants than just Isaac. Remember, he had Ishmael. But the promised land doesn't go through Ishmael's descendants. Only goes through Isaac's descendants. So the promise is narrowed a little bit, the land promise. Genesis 26, 2 through 4, the Lord appeared to him and said, Isaac, and said, do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I will give all these lands. I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So the promise has been given to Isaac's kids, and also descendants, and also Jacob's descendants. Now, Isaac had descendants. Jacob was one of his descendants, but Isaac had other descendants also, but the land promise didn't go to the other descendants of Isaac. The land promise is being even narrowed down to the descendants of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel. The NIV Study Bible points that out. And we read that in Genesis 35, verses 11 through 12. God also said to him, this is to Jacob, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. Which was fulfilled in 1 Kings 4:21. The Israelites, the Old Testament Israelites, eventually got all the land, just as was promised to them. So this promise, this command to go into the land, God knew what he was talking about. He said, I'm going to give you the land, go in there, don't worry about the giants, go in there and take it. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Deuteronomy, chapter 1, verses 1 through 8. In our next audio, we will cover Deuteronomy 1, verses 9 through 46, where the leaders of Israel are appointed. And we will see a recounting of the sad story of how Israel refused to enter the land when Joshua and Caleb said, let's do it, let's go in. But the other 10 spies said, let's don't do it, we're like grasshoppers, and so they didn't do it. So we'll see that in our next audios covering Deuteronomy 1, verses 9 through 46. I hope you stay tuned to hear that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.